Hello, I'm Peter Clark in Melbourne, Australia. Welcome to another Inside Story podcast. We're taking a look at political interviews this time. As we record this discussion, politics has been red hot here in Australia. Malcolm Turnbull recently knocked off Tony Abbott as Prime Minister. Naturally, that process, that event, meant a blizzard of political interviews. Well, yes, it has settled down a little now, but the political interview is currently everywhere. Part of our daily diet in one form or another, from the big set-piece interviews on major current affairs programs to a myriad others on radio, television, online, and, of course, in print. The journalistic media interview seems so familiar to us now, but it's quite a recent cultural invention in that long history of news and journalism. Broadcast interviews arrived even more recently, only a couple of generations ago, really. As a form, the interview is still evolving. The digital revolution is disrupting and transforming our world, we all know that, including the practice of journalism. Mass audiences are fragmenting. New media technologies keep emerging. So, just how important and influential are political interviews these days? Are they largely just empty rituals now? More theatre than information? Has the era of sophisticated spin and intense political messaging swept away any authenticity in these confected public conversations? Are journalistic interviewers keeping up with their skills and techniques? Is the set-piece broadcast interview still an important cog in the machinery of democracy? Or is it on its way out? To help us explore this, two Inside Story contributors, TV critic Jane Goodall, whose recent piece at Inside Story about Labour leader Bill Shorten on the Q&A program dovetails nicely with this discussion, and a political scientist who has worked both sides of the journalistic PR divide, Stephen Mills. Stephen was, amongst other things, once a speechwriter for the former PM, Bob Hawke. Both are with us via Skype lines, Jane in Canberra and Stephen in Sydney. Jane and Stephen, welcome to Inside Story.
Thank you.
Thanks, Peter.
Stephen, how do you actually see the political interview these days? There are a lot of different forms of political interview. Where do they fit in our democracy, Stephen?
Well, I think they still continue to play an absolutely fundamentally important role as a vehicle for political communication by the politicians, and also, equally importantly, as a vehicle for holding those politicians to account through the media. They have spread widely across every form of electronic, not just news, but other forms of public entertainment. They still seem to me to be a pretty good way of bringing voters in contact with the leaders and leaders in contact with the voters, but not in a way that allows either to have a kind of open slather.
Jane, just as important from your perspective?
I agree. I think they're still fundamental. I think there are some contradictions. In some ways, they're more frustrating than they ever were. I feel sometimes with the interviewers, even very smart interviewers, it's almost like a competition for missing the point and just continuing the cycle of spin by picking it up at a particular point and saying, well, this is what we expect next. So the interview becomes a kind of stirring. I think that's been particularly the case with the leadership speculation, where even very prominent, intelligent interviewers like Fran Kelly do nothing for 3 weeks but haul people into the studio to ask them when they're going to assassinate the leader. And then when they've done it, it's, oh my goodness, what do you think you've done? You've got blood on your hands, haven't you? They need to do more to break the cycle rather than just stir it. I think that's something that's coming in now in a denser environment where interviews are actually recycled. You'll hear one done on the radio in the morning, and then it will be part of the news at a later stage in the day because it constitutes a new political piece of Lego in the block for that particular moment.
Or it may be a snippet abridged and popped into another context entirely.
That's right. Or it generates a life of its own because something controversial has happened, like Pine's Fixer interview. Part of the denser environment is that everyone wants a voice. What you sometimes get with the ABC, they'll put up a transcript and then there'll be all kinds of comments on the end of it. Everyone's desperate to get into the conversation. And a lot of those comments are people who clearly just recycle their own views day after day after day. So making a fresh intervention is critically important.
But the fundamental point about who is in charge of an interview really needs to be grasped here. And I'm not much of a cricket fan, but political interviews generally are not that dissimilar to a cricket match and the ever-present contest between bat and ball. Who gets the upper hand? Well, sometimes it's the bat, sometimes it's ball. Sometimes it's the television interviewer who can manage to command and control and ask penetrating questions. Other times it's the interviewee, it's the subject of the interview who just seems to be completely in command and setting the agenda and being able to speak at will. Now, I don't think there's anything particularly wrong with that. It does mean that you get very uneven performances. It does mean that occasionally you'll have, as we've seen recently, Lee Sale's interview with Malcolm Turnbull after he became Prime Minister. That was very slow, soft bowling by her and flourishing drives and on drives by Malcolm Turnbull at the crease, who went on to score a couple of hundred. And then you see, and I know Jane has written about this in Inside Story, you see at the same time, in the same week, Bill Shorten really getting a couple of short, fast deliveries from Tony Jones on Q&A. Tony Jones has got that particular habit of, you know, if it's not quite pointed enough, well, he'll sharpen it up a bit further and bang it through. And then you think, well, you know, the bowling is fully in charge here and the batsman really has to dig in and concentrate, and Shorten did and survived and actually, I thought, came out well from that Q&A experience. You're going to get uneven performances, but it doesn't mean that the underlying game is invalid. It certainly doesn't mean that the batting and bowling that you're seeing on those different performances in some ways kind of improper. I think it's all part of a very rich and diverse ecology, if you like, of political communication.
But Stephen, can I put an example to you? Imagine Andrew Robb sitting there in front of, again, let's choose Lee Sales, talking about the trade agreement with China. And the accusations have been flying around that any opposition to that trade agreement is xenophobic or even racist. Yet we haven't got any detail. The detail hasn't been released. We've just got a minister sitting there trying to assure us, attacking the other side. How do we get any authentic information out of that? Or are we just watching the performance of Andrew Robb and the performance of Lee Sales?
What we're seeing there is a pretty skillful politician in Andrew Robb who is delivering his key messages. And I think we can't go very far in a conversation about political interviews without understanding this concept of the key messages. So prior to any political press conference or interview, the politician isn't just going into these things unprepped or unready or keen to have the interviewer, you know, set the agenda, as it were. The politician is obviously with his or her media advisors working out, well, what really do we want to say in this process? What are our key messages and their political goal? I mean, we're just inferring here from what we see. We don't actually know, but we can presume that these kinds of conversations took place. What do we want, you know, from the government point of view to communicate about CHAFTA? Well, we want to make sure it's passed through in full, that it relates to our broader agenda of trade agreements being part of economic growth. We want to keep the Chinese on side. We want to keep the Americans on side by not being too chummy to the Chinese. And we want to give a couple of swipes to Labour on the way through. Now, I mean, this is not rocket science, and nor is it new. I mean, this has been going on for a long, long time. When Robb is saying that opposition to these Labour agreements, Labour arrangements in the China Free Trade Agreement, when he's describing those as xenophobic, look, it's a political line. Yes, it's spin. Yes, it's deliberate. No, it's not in direct answer to the question that he was asked, but it is a core part of political communications. And so, Peter, your question, what's the audience to make of it? Well, the audience, they're not idiots. They are aware of the kind of processes going on, and it's going to be open to the audience to say, well, hang on, Andrew Robb did not answer that question. He just embarked on a process of ad hominem slander and throwing around names and so forth. As the bat versus ball contest gets hotter, well, the spectators are aware of what is going on here. They take it all on board. They are able to see both the tactics of the bowler and of the batsman.
It's an interesting case, that one, though. I think I'm a bit more troubled by it than you are, Stephen. The cricket analogy is nice because cricket is such a stylish and tactical game, and you can play it well or badly. You can have players ill-matched in skill. But in the case of the free trade agreement, you have a government now headed by Turnbull, whose first platform speech when he made the challenge was, I am going to explain the economy, and I'm going to have done with the three-word slogans. Well, what happens when the first major economic issue comes out, which is the free trade agreement? The minister gets on and he trots out a three-word slogan, union scare campaign. Why isn't the interviewer on the ball saying, look, sorry, I thought you guys were in the business of explaining this and you're not explaining it. It doesn't happen. Time and again, they don't even play the ball. They just drop it. I think sometimes it's just entertainment. I mean, there's a lot at stake in an interview about Manus Island or the free trade agreement. But to go back to the fixer example, I watched that interview again. And Spears was lovely, David Spears on Sky News, because he's very experienced and he obviously knows Pine. And Pine is a weird guy as an interview subject because half of him just ought to be a vaudeville performer. He's got the most brilliant comic timing. I mean, his comic timing is actually as good as John Clark's, which is who he got negatively compared to.
He hasn't got a bad face for comedy either.
I mean, in many ways, he's a nightmare as a politician. But he comes into the studio, he cuts into what Spears is saying, he role reverses, he takes the lead on the pace of the interview. He cuts right through it with this funny little dialogue about I'm a fixer. And it's got a lovely comic rhythm to it. Spears sees it happening and he kind of just lets it roll. He watches it, he makes sure it doesn't go where it shouldn't go, and he allows Pine to hang himself on his own rope. So that can happen. I thought Alberici, in contrast to what we're critiquing, the Rob interview, Alberici handled an extremely difficult and fraught interview with Peter Dutton about Manus Island. She worked really hard to keep that on the rails, on the line. It's a critically important issue. You know, lives are at stake in Manus. People are in utter misery. There's tremendously strong feeling in the community. You know, if you look at the comment lines, the bipolarity of the Australian public on this issue is very serious. And I thought she carried that responsibility superbly. She was very alert throughout. She was quick thinking and she steered it right through the end on every point. But that's unusual.
Jane and Stephen, could I take you to another example? And following on from what you said earlier, Stephen, about preparation for these interviews and getting the message right. Staying with Lee Sales in her first interview with Morrison when he became Treasurer after the vote for Malcolm Turnbull to become Prime Minister. Treasurer Morrison comes in with that message, Stephen, doesn't he? And his message is, we don't have a revenue problem, we have an expenditure problem. Now, Lee Sales wrestled with that proposition almost right through the interview. What can an interviewer do, Jane, with someone like Morrison, who is one of the toughest interviewees around, I reckon, who's capable of playing all those games that he does? What can an interviewer do with that when the whole framing of the concept is in his court and he's holding on to it?
That's an interesting case. And I've given Sales a few brickbats, but she can be very bad and very good. And I think she was pretty good on that one. Economic ground is the hardest. It's the hardest of all. And we make big calls on these frontline interviewers, the top of the range ones. It's an extremely difficult job. The terrain moves fast and all sorts of different things are happening in it. But with the economy, I think they need backup. I mean, listening to Stephen Shakur about Hard Talk, he says, in a way, number one factor in making that program work is first-rate research by his team. Now, he's no fool himself. He's got a superb education and background, and I'm sure he does some of the research too.
Jane, the night before, of course, Lee Sales had the former head of Treasury on in the form of Ken Henry, who'd gone through this idea of expenditure and revenue, and Lee Sales, naturally enough, put that straight to Scott Morrison.
So she was prepared. But there's such a dialogue going on, again, partly through Corbyn in the UK, Bernie Sanders in the US, and some leading economists like Kruger, Stiglitz, and, of course, Varoufakis, the rockstar ex-Greek Minister of Finance, and Thomas Piketty, whose book has become a bestseller that nobody reads. There is some very heavy-hitting critique now of this assumption that everything's always about growth, about avoiding deficits. The fear of austerity is now almost the number one political issue in the UK, and certainly in parts of Europe it is. And for someone like Morrison to think he can get away with just running that glib line is ridiculous.
I think you're being very hard on Scott Morrison at this point, and in fact hard on Lee Sales as well. I saw the same interview. I thought Morrison was actually on thin ice there. That interview presented significant political risk for Morrison and for any brand new treasurer. The complexity of the economic underlying issues, the amount of jargon that surrounds it, the nuance that's required to successfully communicate it, all these make the job of treasurer, shadow treasurer, one of the hardest in politics. Scott Morrison, completely untested in an economic portfolio. From a political point of view, I think it's Turnbull's most risky appointment, and we just really don't know how Morrison is going to turn out as treasurer. He did get off to a shaky start. Before the revenue spending argument, there was the work, save and invest three-word slogan on the very first day he was appointed. I think it's a bit hard to expect a new treasurer, especially where the government is so clearly looking at mini budgets and, you know, tax packages and elections down the corner, to do much more. So in cricket analogy, you know, Morrison was blocking. He wasn't trying to make big sweeping shots here. He did successfully defend his view that it was a spending problem, not a revenue problem. You know, so I mean, I think it was, from his point of view, a successful operation in a highly risky position. And then, of course, he lost it all when he responded glibly to Sales's presentation of economic data.
Lee Sales, right towards the end of the interview, used exactly the same formulation that she'd used in an earlier interview with Tony Abbott. She ran through those key aspects of economic data. And then she said to him, "What do you say to the Australian people who elected you to solve, in the words of the government, a budget emergency and a crisis, and you've been elected, and in fact Australia's economic position has worsened?" Scott Morrison says, "Well, I don't agree it has, Lee, but when you look at the rate of growth," and then got cut off again by Lee Sales, "I just cited all the numbers." Morrison says, "Well, Lee, that's your take on what all that means." Lee Sales, "No, it's not. It's just a recitation of the facts." Finally, Scott Morrison says, "Well, no, Lee, no, let me answer the question," and then goes on to do quite a deal of blah, blah, and doesn't answer the question. So, Jane, what do we make of that?
Oh, look, there's no question she scored there. When she's good, she's very, very good. And I thought it was very clever to reuse that section of data that she used notoriously with Abbott, who answered he'd stop the boats. But I think what you can do is something that Turnbull was kind of asking them to do, which is to move away from the game of, he called it the gotcha game.
Yes.
Where you try to get back a politician against the wall and say, "Are you going to do this? Or will you rule that out?" And then the next time you interview them, you play the game the other way and say, "Oh, but you said you'd do this and then you didn't do that." That's really boring. And I don't think it's terribly relevant. And it's very unrealistic because we're on changing political ground. I mean, the fact that Gillard had to spend so much of her time as Prime Minister defending herself against charges that she was a liar because she'd brought in the carbon tax. I mean, for goodness sake, she was leading a hung parliament in which all policies had to be reconsidered with new players at the table. And, you know, when the Liberal Party, the coalition, got in this time around, Freudian slip there, the coalition got in this time around, they had to deal with new economic parameters, Chinese growth falling away, the end of the mining boom, the GFC, which had caused a necessity for stimulus during Rudd's time, was no longer the key issue. So they simply had something that looked like a deficit with no good reason for it. And so they played the game as a kind of heavy blame game against the previous incumbent. And that's a very one-dimensional picture to play with. Somebody's got to unlock that and make it more complex and interesting and meaningful. But I think what they can do is move away from policy and go to principle. Okay, we accept that we're in changing times and circumstances. What are your underlying values? Mm. Where will you really hold the line? What are your priorities? Do you think this is more important than this? And if so, why? I think then you start to get a sense of who you're dealing with at the steering wheel, where you feel as a voter you might back them or not, or feel comfortable to go the way they're going or not.
So a process of testing values, though Lee Sales did try that with Malcolm Turnbull the other night, but it opened the gate to a whole lot of blather from Turnbull as well, very abstract, very generalised sort of blather.
Well, that might be quite revealing. I wouldn't really like to quote the script because it was awful. You know, I'm about to say something a bit personal, and she started apologising. And then the terrible thing she said was about to say to him was, "You have a brilliant mind." And I was sitting there thinking, really? Well, I haven't heard it, not in this conversation. And I thought curiously that very embarrassing flattery approach showed him up to be quite shallow. I don't know where the substance is. I'm waiting to hear it.
Just to go back to Lee Sales and Scott Morrison, Peter, which you summarised her words in the exchange, and I just want to go back to the very beginning of your quote there, where you're quoting Lee inviting Morrison to walk away from the previous government's or the previous treasurer's debt and deficit and budget emergency kind of language.
Yes.
Now, this was a very important point, and let's not let Lee Sales kind of, or journalism, escape with that. She is not at that point engaging in a debate about the economy. It looks like she is, and she went on to talk about what she said were facts, although they're statistics, which is slightly different.
Yes.
Indeed.
They're all selected. So she was basically setting a rhetorical trap for Morrison, which, of course, he saw coming a mile off, because he cannot say there is no budget deficit, no budget emergency. He can't say that. Why? Whether or not there is a budget emergency, in other words, whether or not there's some underlying substance, is irrelevant to this point. What it is, it's a rhetorical, purely discursive operation. Will you criticise your predecessor? How are you going to distinguish yourself and differentiate yourself from the previous guys? That's a new story. Morrison bags hockey. Morrison distances from Abbott. And he knew that. Lee Sales, that's why she was asking it. We in the audience have got to know that. The rhetorical or discursive layer, plane on which many of these discussions take place, they're only superficially or nominally about some underlying policy issue. I find this fascinating to watch, and I think the ultimate justification for them is that we're not idiots. We can see these either overly aggressive tactics or overly defensive tactics or overly pre-cooked responses and so forth. We can see them all happening. And we learn about the underlying character of the politician and of the journalist, but especially of the politician, our elected representatives, from seeing these interplays and these exchanges over numerous times.
Jane, you alluded to a request from now Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull to people like Emma Alberici and Lee Sales to be less aggressive and more forensic. I can see why he wants less aggression, but those politicians don't always respond, as we've just been discussing, well, to a bit more forensic approach in an interview. But I want to ask both of you this. Is there a place for some level of aggression, for force of personality, for pushing the interviewee around who's obfuscating and avoiding revealing authentic information? Is there a role for some kind of rudeness, Jane?
Well, there is a kind of dramaturgy about interviews. And the interviewer can play a role, and of course so can the subject of the interview. I think myself, you get best value when that's pretty pared back. I do not like interviewers who come in with too much personality and too much interpersonal energy. I mean, the energetics of an interview is interesting. That the interviewers who draw you in as a viewer or a listener often are much slower, quieter, and that enables them to heighten their own concentration, to watch their moment, to give the person enough space to reveal something that they can then really do something with. Not always in an adversarial way, sometimes just really advance the dialogue. There's a line that you can identify with regard to rudeness. And what happens in a personal conversation is certain kinds of tone are rude, interrupting is rude, refusing to allow somebody to say a certain kind of thing is rude, dominating the conversation is rude. But actually the interviewer needs to do all those things in a political interview. There's an adversarial element in the situation. I draw the line on the ad hominem principle. Avoid questions that are addressed to the person or the personality. I hate it when the interviewer goes to the terrain of, why should the Australian people trust you? I think that's just going for broke. It's highly inappropriate. And what on earth can be said in response to it, unless it's a really extreme situation? I think that they need to stick to the issue. They need to stick to a line of inquiry and to keep it away from the personality. I don't like flattery as much as I don't like rudeness. It's about who controls and how. I think Turnbull gets a lot of sycophancy, and so does Julie Bishop, who knows how to set it up because she's got a hell of a persona working for her.
Stephen, interruption. When you read the comments, that's something that the audience gets very upset about, their favourite politician being interrupted. Yet what Sarah Ferguson did as interviewer when she was in the chair of the 7:30 show, she brooked no nonsense. I do have a line of inquiry here, and she persisted with that line of inquiry. So in that general question about rudeness, where does interruption fit in your view?
Sarah Ferguson's a really interesting example, a highly skilled interviewer, because I think I agree with all of what Jane just said, but I'd add another layer to it as well, which is, of course, that these are not conversations between friends. They're not interviews between equals. There's always a power imbalance in these relationships. If a television journalist is interviewing an ordinary member of the public, you know, somebody involved in a court case or a traffic accident or something like that, the journalist is expected to show sympathy, compassion. And of course, you would not be rude to a person who is an ordinary citizen who's doing you a favour by appearing on their show. You wouldn't be rude or high-handed to them. It's different with politicians, obviously, or perhaps senior business figures, people who have power. In those cases, actually, our kind of social coding of those, I think, is that we expect journalists to be a little bit deferential. And that's a bit of an unusual word to say in Australian politics, I know. But in fact, I think audiences expect a degree of deference, not so much rudeness and not so much aggression. Look, there is a place for rudeness and aggression in questioning, but I think there are some real constraints around a journalist interviewing a prime minister, and a little bit of deference is required, a little bit of rope is required, even if all they're going to do is to hang themselves with it.
Jane, not so long ago, just the general population didn't even know what spin was, and they didn't talk about spin. Now everybody has that feeling of what spin is right in their gut, and they talk about spin, and they describe interviews they see on television or hear on the radio as being full of spin. So spin is sort of centre stage these days. People in the business know that these politicians and corporate leaders and other powerful people are very well prepped, as Stephen said earlier, and they have media minders and they have a lot of techniques and a lot of training. Are we now looking at the situation where journalists need to come up with much better techniques to counter that intense level of media management?
I think so. When you watch a Keating interview, he's an absolute spinball bowler. He never just repeats a line. He's always got a different way of doing it. If you watch him, Keating took his time, and what he had to say or to communicate was as much done through facial expression and pauses as through the actual words spoken. And the rhythms of the speech are very interesting. So he was able to bring an element of unpredictability. And if there's one thing I wish we could get, it's more unpredictability. And that means moving away from the pre-script of any kind. And I think the interviewers need to work as hard to do that as the politicians do. But going back to Sarah Ferguson, she came in pretty hard when she was doing the 7:30 report. But it's worth remembering she also did those interviews in the Killing Season. Really, I found that quite a revelation. And she played a minimal role. Of course, she could have edited a lot of it out. But she was a very quiet presence in that. She didn't do interrupting. They got lots of time. And it was the first time I had really been aware that what Gillard did in that situation did not match the account of it she wanted to have out there. Something else was going on. And the more Gillard tried to explain herself, the clearer it became that she really had been a proactive instigator of this. May have made a real error of judgment. And I say that with some reluctance. You know, I never believed that line at the time she was prime minister. But I came to see it very differently in interview. And I came to see Rudd very differently.
Sarah Ferguson gave a speech down in Melbourne. She says that both Gillard and Rudd were extremely inimical to the media in general, not to her personally, but to the media in general from their respective point of views. Some excellent interviews, and yes, Jane, the interviewer was pretty non-interventionist, so it was quite an interesting style. I did, though, feel that she intervened extensively as an editor. Hawke wasn't the only one to say this, but Hawke quite liked live TV because he was good enough to cope with it. Keating certainly was brilliant as a live TV and radio interview subject. They were much more wary about edited for the obvious reason that they didn't always get the last word. My critique is that it had been edited in such a way so as to deny Gillard the last word. On several occasions where Gillard makes an assertion which is then put to Rudd and he says, no, that's nonsense. And there are far fewer occasions on which Rudd's accusations and allegations and various views and so forth are put to Gillard, allowing her an opportunity for the last word. So a different structure, isn't it, when you've got an editing hand which is shaping and structuring the interview in a way other than the pure sequence in which it took place.
When you look at a program that's equivalent to Four Corners, like Background Briefing on Radio National, when you listen to those programs, they're very carefully crafted. But it's worth just quickly mentioning, since Jane did write that piece on Q&A, that Q&A on ABC television and Insight on SBS television, they're both incredibly crafted programs, and they put themselves forward as a forum where people can ask questions almost spontaneously. None of that is spontaneous, Jane, is it?
No, and I think there's a lot of viewer frustration with that. It's interesting that when they do one without politicians, you get a lot of tweets saying what a relief it is to just hear people being intelligent. And I think that's a nice barometer of the degree to which people really are fed up with hearing the party line trotted out. And the more aggressively it's done, the worse it comes across in Q&A. But I guess it's quite a theatrical forum, really. It's a bit overpumped.
If we're talking about media training, I'm reminded of Henry Kissinger, who, when he was the US Secretary of State, began a press conference in front of the world's journalists by saying, well, has anybody got a question for the answer that I want to provide? And it just, you know, in other words, regardless of the questions that you've got, I've only got a certain amount of material that I can say, and I'm going to say it. So ask a question, but I'm still going to give this answer. That's what, you know, Turnbull and Shorten do today. They walk into the interview or the press conference with their key messages already sorted out and, you know, has anybody got a question which they would like to ask so that I can provide my key messages?
Stephen and Jane, could I wrap this conversation by picking up on what you were just saying, Jane, this word unpredictability, and could I wed it with that other important word for me anyway, and that's authenticity. Is it possible that this set-piece style of interview that we've been generally discussing today on Inside Story is going to disappear finally as mass media itself starts to dissolve away and large numbers of communities of interest emerge? Has the interview almost died within our media ecosystem, or is there a future for the political interview? Stephen, what do you think?
Oh, I think there's a definite future for it. I mean, audiences will fragment driven by technology and demographics, but I think as a form of interaction between the politician as an agent seeking to do things and the media as a, if you like, popular representative seeking to hold the politician to account, I think that relationship is too important to do away with, and I think it will continue in some form. And of course, you know, the interview lives in many other formats other than a news exchange. I mean, interviews are critical in print journalism. They're critical in academic research. I mean, my line of research, qualitative research, all built around interviews. Authenticity, like there's nothing harder to fake than sincerity, you know. We absolutely want to see, and we are entitled to see, our leaders as they are. But of course we never do, and we never will. But this is the best alternative. This is the next best way of seeing them. Politics is not supposed to be like easy or a cakewalk, especially election campaigns, are supposed to be full of tests and trials, you know, so that you can see whether these politicians are actually any good. And one of the biggest tests and trials is doing a media interview. If they muck up this, they're not going to go far. You know, we talk about the 24/7 media cycle. And there's a lot of gnashing of teeth and hair tearing about how relentless politics it is and how damaging it is for deliberation and for discussion. The politicians' view on that, typically, is that they blame the media for that. I've never bought that argument and I don't buy it. Corbyn is showing, also kind of at the opposite end of the spectrum, Abbott showed in his early days as Prime Minister, it's this, that you can break the cycle if you're the politician. If you're the journalist, you can't break the cycle. Journalists have their deadlines and it's the nature of journalism to ask the follow-up question and to move the story on. Politicians have it in their capacity to change the tempo, change the timing, to break the cycle. Perhaps where this future of interview question will head is that, you know, we may see fewer, or if we see fewer engagements between politicians and media, I don't think that's really a bad thing.
I agree that it remains a really central area of our political life, the interviewer. And I'd probably go further. I think it's becoming more important and more interesting and perhaps more genuinely dramatic. Things happen in those encounters that have a very catalytic afterlife in the political scene. I'd just like to see the catalytic qualities of it really working.
We know that the communication experts talk about the fading of the one-to-many model of communication. We're now evolving into the many-to-many model of communications. Could we see a burgeoning of that many-to-many? In other words, could most of us in some form or another become interviewers, Jane, in the future?
Well, I have been really studying comment lines, and I have to confess, contributing to them more often than I ought to. You have to deal with the fact that most people are not interesting to anyone other than themselves. It is a highly skilled business, interviewing. I would not like to see amateurs trying to take it over. What I would like to see, though, is much more openness amongst producers in the media to bringing new people in. We're forever getting the same old, same old. They let people spin their careers far too long. People get reputations as, you know, distinguished or senior journalists who've really got nothing to say. They got that reputation a long time ago. People who are doing well, we need to kind of support them and bring more people into that front rank. I'd just like to see a wider sphere of talent, that's all.
Stephen?
I may be the only person left in the world who watches John Clarke and Brian Dawe, but I mean, if we're talking about interviews and the satire of the interview, I mean, just tragically, side-splittingly deft, potent, you know, maybe this is where we're headed, because you can only watch Clarke and Dawe if you've watched like 47 other thousand interviews and you're kind of kitted up, as most of us are in 2015, kitted up with all of the tools and the tricks that both journalists and politicians use to get to negotiate these contests.
What a great place to finish on the on the satirical interview. And of course, as you point out, Stephen, all dependent, really, our appreciation of their humour, dependent on the millions of interviews we've all absorbed over the years. And thank you to both of you for a great conversation today on Inside Story. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Our two Inside Story contributors, TV critic Jane Goodall and political scientist Stephen Mills. Now, check this website for further information, including some links, some of the references we made in our conversation, they'll be there. I'm Peter Clark in Melbourne, Australia. Thanks for listening and talk to you again soon. Bye for now.